We are checking back in with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy for this week's Tacky Talk podcast. How are you, Tacky?
Hey, Joe, good to see you on a Sunday, Tuesday, March 12th.
I know, I never know where we're going to find you. It's last week you were in a suit and tie in your office, all professional. Here you are back at home.
Yeah, well, this is kind of the nature of remote work and ability. You can find me whenever you want. Remember the days where I actually had to schedule time to come to the studio?
Yes, oh, those old days.
Those old days of me having to get my car, come visit you. Now it's like Joe calls me up and like we want to do an interview. I'm like, I don't have time. And he's like, I got time. I know where you are.
That's right. But it's okay because this is the way of the world now. It's not going away.
Yeah, I got 2 days of meetings lined up for Wednesday and Thursday. So it's obviously we're a little ahead of schedule on a weekly basis, but as you all know, we try to make time for everyone the best we can, not always successfully. But we always make a very strong effort to do so. And this is why it's a Tuesday. We actually had time today. Next 2 days, I'm actually packed up on in-person meetings for next 2 days in sales.
Actually, today, maybe it's good you're not there because there's rallies going on about the minimum wage debate.
Yeah, it's interesting how that's good debate's going to continue. There's a few things going on. One is the ballot question regarding tip workers' minimum wage. For those who aren't aware, there is a minimum wage for tip workers, but it's not the minimum wage you see for standard wage workers. Is that if the tips they make that day doesn't make the minimum wage under the law, the worker or the restaurant has to make up the differential on the minimum wage and the tips. So obviously, the economy's hard in terms of inflation, and people are being more discretionary about eating out. And I do not encourage people to not tip their workers there because that's pretty much how they make the money and they're going to get ahead of the minimum wage. But we do tip against the size of the bill as a percentage. And those days of 10% when I was a kid is now 20, 25% today. And I understand there's a pinch going on folks. And I think restaurants and wait staff understand there's the pinch going on because they feel it too. So, there's that proposal out there, and there's another proposal to incrementally increase the minimum wage to $20. This is actually pretty interesting because not so much an increase in the minimum wage from $15 to $20. I still can't figure out what the medium hourly wage is currently. Wage inflation is not just a corporate issue. Wage inflation is a Main Street issue. The restaurants and retail stores that are down the street from us on Hancock Street all face wage inflation as they all compete for workers, whether it be in store or drivers or any other type of services they need. And of course, there's a pass on cost. If the provider of your goods have increased wages, they'd have to pass that cost to the restaurants and retailers, who then pass the cost on to you. Most times, wages inflation is such a small moving item. It does go up. People's wages go up, they just go slowly. You actually don't feel the cost that much. That's why minimum wage increases are done over the course of several years. It's going up, but you don't actually feel it in your pocketbook because it's so small and incremental. But today, in the last 2 years, you definitely felt it. You most definitely have felt it. You may not realize it, but you felt the impact of wage inflation on top of other inflationary costs to your pocketbook when you go to the supermarket or you go out to eat or you go to the movie theater or whatever you do. So, there's two debates going on. One is the ballot question on tip wage going to the same rate as minimum wages. And then the debate's going on about whether we should increase the minimum wage to $20. But I always find it's important to find what the median wage is first before we jump to that. And they honestly think that's still a moving number for at least another year.
Yeah, it's for tip workers, it's $6.75 an hour right now. I think the minimum is $15 right now.
Yes, and proposed ballot question jumps it up to $15. That's the minimum from 6.75. And was it 25? I sorry, I can't remember what you just
Think it's
told me.
75. Yeah.
75. So, I mean, restaurant owners, sorry, would have to make a, go to $15 an hour as a
Right.
start. And it looks more slowly like countries that don't tip. They actually require restaurants to pay minimum wage as opposed to a tipping. So most countries don't tip. It is a very foreign thing for most of the world now. I mean, when I was last in Australia many years ago, they told us they jacked up the minimum wage intentionally to a point where basically tipping is no longer a thing that you don't tip because of the nature of how they increase the minimum wage for restaurant workers.
Yeah, it would be a major cultural shift in this country if that were to happen, for sure.
You know what really hurt service workers because tipping is a big part of their salary structure and the wage structure is built around tipping. And not surprising, folks that work in higher end restaurants get more, and restaurants are very successful over high turnover in tables. Those workers get a lot more money on tips than they would on the minimum wage. And this is kind of one of the big challenges on trying to get rid of tipping. It's just ingrained in the economics for people who are in the service industry. And that includes folks that work in hotels. I mean, I do tip a few dollars per day stay or $5 per day or whatever. Depending on the service I receive in hotels on housekeeping, I do leave money behind with thank you notes. So there's that component too. And it's just a little bit extra appreciation. So I think the tip debate here, if you try to get rid of it in the United States, would be really, really challenging. And it would have to be done at the federal level because you don't want to be tipping in Massachusetts, but Connecticut bans it.
Right, it would be very confusing at that point. Yeah, and talk about struggling to get workers at that point. If that were the case, if every state was different.
That's correct. Because again, the nature of how service industry works, particularly in restaurants, the different restaurants, different situations creates better opportunities to make better money. One of the challenges that people advocate for this ballot question is that not all times in restaurants are all equal times of business. So if you get a shift on a day when, for whatever reason, it's not good, so like you get a midday shift. Between lunch and dinner. So you got like a dinner shift, but you're out before dinner time. You may not have as good volume as dinner. The price structure, dinner tends to be a little bit higher than lunch. Perhaps you're working on a day when there's a major weather event and there's not as many people coming in. So you don't get as many tips. And then there's also the takeout factor, which happened in a pandemic. People do not generally tip as much when they're getting takeout. You may leave a couple bucks in the front of the counter, but the reality is that you're not really getting a wait service.
Right, and you don't really know what happens with those tip jars either. You know, if they're shared equally, or you just don't know. But where you have a personal relationship with your server sitting at a table, you know.
That's correct. I mean, this under IRS rules, I believe that money becomes taxable income as part of the restaurant. But is, obviously it's up to the restaurant to decide to do that since it's cash driven. It's not like the tax collector standing over your shoulder. I suspect, you guys can figure out the rest on your own. But, it's a case by case basis of different owners and different managers, how they want to manage that. So, obviously, takeout has a huge impact on service workers. I don't see takeout anytime soon. I still believe that maybe a third to 40% of the workforce, particularly in the white collar sector, the white collar sector in particular, but it's going to be continuing to work from home.
Yeah, it's funny. I was reading an article about that this morning, actually, that a lot large part of the economy now is being driven by women working from home, and it's probably part of the reason that we haven't dipped into a recession.
Yes, it's the continuation of a consumer economy, like 70% ish, give or take, depending whose math you want to use, is driven by consumer consumption. So we're what I like to call a circular money economy. We keep putting money back into the economy that the economy pays us, so to speak, to keep the economy moving. We're not a manufacturing country anymore, where you make stuff and you sell it to somebody outside the country, and you get your money that way. So, that, again, it's like that ties to wage inflation too, because you're not selling your goods overseas, that someone else overseas paid for those wages, like we pay for other people's wages overseas because we buy the goods from overseas. It's money that's moving in a weird, like, kind of circle. And if the consumer stops spending, it impacts the retailers, service industry folks, because they have reduction in money, and then that results in them have to make a decision on whether or not to lay people off, reduce wages. Conversely, when you have inflation, you see the opposite effect, where they have to raise prices to meet their costs, and then the consumer on the other end, have to make those decisions about whether or not they can afford to pay. And then, it becomes this kind of vicious cycle. The same happens with deflation. If things start to decline, negative growth in terms of negative wages, negative prices, and then it results in the workers having negative wages. It starts to spiral going the other direction. So, given the fact that people are still making some money and, still trying to figure out what their needs are, even though I think people are being increasingly discretionary and more conscientious of what they're paying for, people in the workforce, both men and women, or working, as I said earlier, white collar jobs in particular, drive a lot of the home based economy, where your local economy, your town may not see as much business, the local coffee shop or the restaurant, or midday sales at the retailer or a supermarket, because people are at home with some more flexible hours, and it kind of drives the economy a different way. Like, there's the Roche Brothers in Downtown Crossing in Boston, but when that is very full in terms of the financial district in particular, people may stop in and buy a couple of pieces of fruit on the way to Downtown Crossing. That is not happening. People are working from home. And then if they decide they want to, get some quick shopping done in between meetings, like I sometimes do, I won't lie. You try to get in for like 30 quick minutes, grab what you need from wherever you grab it back, and you try to get back in time for your next meeting.
Yeah, funny we're talking about this because I know before we started recording, you were looking at the latest consumer price index numbers.
Yeah, it's still very sticky. You hear this term a lot, sticky inflation. Sitting at 3.2% from last year, it went up 0.4%. The estimate was 0.3%, so it's a tenth of a percentage. Core PCE will be coming in later in the week, but the rough look at core CPE, PCE, price consumer index with no fuel and housing, continues to look very high, in the high 3 point, I think 3.9 zone. And unemployment's, trapped below that 4% level. I mean, unemployment went up to 3.9%, and just won't crack that 4%. So, there's some revisions on job gains and losses the last 2 months, but clearly it doesn't move the needle that hard on the percentages of unemployment. So, we're kind of in this trap zone where the Federal Reserve Bank wants to get inflation down 2%, but it's really having this rough time getting under 3%. And the core PCE is the big one, because that's more of our everyday kind of like day-to-day life impacts. So Federal Reserve is very concerned about the consumer being able to sustain this economy if it's too expensive.
Can we talk a little bit about the governor's plan to pardon some simple marijuana convictions, Jackie?
Well, when we passed the marijuana law, part of it is expungement of records. So we had basically passed a law to require basically the AG and DA's offices to work towards expunging records for basically misdemeanors. More serious crimes, obviously, if it's not just marijuana usage and there's other underlying crimes, well, that are much more serious. Obviously, the misdemeanor marijuana crime is not that serious, but it doesn't mean you erase the much more heavier crimes.
Okay.
I don't know who the governor's looking to expunge, given the fact that we've been spending quite a bit of time since legalization of marijuana going through the list, and I'm sure a defense attorney is also looking around to make sure that everybody, prior minor offenses are have their records cleared. So I'm not sure how the governor's looking at these pardons, because it's been going on for a while, so it's got to be something else as part of the sentence that's beyond just the misdemeanor. And something maybe more serious, but not very dangerous.
Okay, I think tomorrow is going to be the release of some of the details in terms of the crimes committed, how far back she's talking about, things like that.
It's also pretty unusual. Governors very rarely do pardons this early in your career. It generally happens towards the end of their first term or end of the second term. They do a very thoughtful and long analysis before they do this type of bargains. So I'm not entirely clear why they're doing this early. There's nothing that says they can't do it, but it's a little surprising.
Did you read the story from the Greater Boston Chamber of Commerce, folks? looking to move out of Massachusetts, young people, basically.
Not a new story. This is like a repeating conversation that we've had since the end of the dot-com boom. And the reason's because not just expensive, because everyone knows rent is expensive and housing expensive, but also is a quality of life issue. I mean, when we last looked at studies years ago, many years ago now, surveying younger folks on why they're leaving the state, and they're going to high tax areas like New York and San Francisco. The answer was because of quality of life for them, not quality of life for us. We like to promote ourselves as a family-friendly area. That's great. If you don't have a family, it doesn't mean a whole lot, right? And I'm getting too old, and I have no idea what young people enjoy anymore. But if those amenities that are not available here, there's other opportunities in other places that, maybe a little bit lower cost of living, that are growing economies that need their type of workers. Right off the bat, I'm thinking like Charlotte, North Carolina. Lower cost of living, city that's really growing, a lot of evening and late night activities. Texas is another location. I was Austin when we talked in Austin was at Google headquarters. I did go out for an evening and didn't realize you could actually have fun at, Thursday. Well past midnight and very hopping entertainment district where there's bars, there's theaters, there's live entertainment.
That's a big music culture there. Yeah, I know. Yep.
Yeah, and of course the college town is right in the middle of Austin as well. So I was like, huh. And of course I would get caught in like this torrential downpour that night because I can't do weeknight all night things. I just can't anymore.
Yes, no, we're not as young as we used to be, right?
Regretfully, it even I have can't do. No, I can't. It's just too hard. So, but it was interesting, and part of fun of travel is that you get to see how other young people, and what kind of culture these cities have, on what they provide for, the evening nightlife, not just for impact on business, but also the people who live there, and. I'm not surprised. And we're going to continue to have this talent drain from a myriad of factors I talked about. I mean, housing is expensive, cost of living is expensive, wages have a challenge at keeping up the cost of living in this greater Boston area. Boston, in particular, is among the top five most expensive places to live and work in the country, if not the world at this point. And what's keeping you here, right? If you got no fun because you are young enough that you can stay out and go back to work tomorrow. Functional somehow, where's the fun in that, right? And you also want to meet people outside of the office, and the ability to meet people in bars. I mean, is kind of part of it as well. Or you use an app to date with, but you need a meeting place at like 9 o'clock after people get out of work or whatever. You want to meet up and you want to do something fun. You don't just want to just meet people on the street, right?
So,
So
yeah,
people
one
keep.
of the factors that was cited that I thought was interesting was the public transportation issue, and especially folks in the lower income brackets find that a challenge.
Well, that's always been a challenge. That's not new. I mean, the MBTA has been, problematic currently, but it's been problematic since the Deval Patrick administration. And I mean, the point of Massachusetts public transit, the MBTA in particular, is designed to allow lower income folks to be able to leave the greater Boston area to go to suburban communities to find work. Most people think it's actually the other way around. It's actually not. That's why we have a fixed fare system. We're one of two states left, us in New York, has a fixed fare system. Most everywhere else, fare system is, in globally speaking, everywhere else, has a fare system where you pay by distance. So you're going from one to three stops. The fare for one to three, can be a few cents or dime or whatever differential. If you're going longer distances, you're looking at several dollars or greater, for longer distance travels. And the idea is that, people that live closer to the workplace generally have a lower income bracket. If you live far, far away, you're coming from a suburban community. The challenge of MBTA, we talked a lot about it, is the fare system itself. It's not like other places where suburban communities where you have more money, are paying more to travel to Boston as opposed to somebody that that doesn't have as much money, and it's kind of a weird inequitable system that is uniquely Massachusetts. In New York, I mean, there's always the shock from other folks when they go to other states and other countries using public transit, and they realize they have to pay more. And you got this fare system to push all these buttons, and then you have a ticket, and the ticket only lets you out in certain areas unless you have the pass. And it's much more engaged. But those transit systems, as a result of the type of fare program, actually have more money because they're basically making people more money pay more. So that's kind of why we have the single fare system. But there's a consequence for that. And young people, when they go to these other places, will pay more money to ride better transit. And this is something that Massachusetts ridership and MBTA do not understand. And they always want us to compare us to other states. And I understand why. But the one thing they always overlook, even in news articles, is the fare system. I've yet to see a newspaper article talk about fare systems in other states and do an analysis regarding the cost benefit for those states under fare system and its relative to taxpayer subsidies for these MBTA transit. There is no transit system in the US that is not subsidized by taxpayers. But there is, the need for these fare systems and what the cost benefit is. And other countries privatize their public transit where the government is the majority shareholder by a big number. But the government can issue shares to the public to fund their public transit. This is something that you have to do at the onset of the construction. You can't just midway through a point to just change it to a private sector thing. You gotta do it at the very beginning of your construction of public transit, which is not uncommon around the world. And it's also not common for other parts of the world to try to have other public transits manage other people's public transits, or at least manage a public transit to the point where they get started and the public transit can take it from there. So, that's something that happens other places too. So, yeah, I mean, young people want to get around. That being said, the T also closes at, one, almost 1 a.m. between 12:30 and 1. The bars in Boston's open to 2. And as we talked about, it's a single track system, and you need those 4-ish hours to get your guys out there to do track maintenance as well as, basically, hose down all the cars and the buses, overnight, and do all your bus maintenance, during those hours as well. With a dual track system like New York does, you could be running your trains down one track, and then you can have maintenance going the other one. Obviously, safety is a concern because you're working on a track where a train's going by you on the other side. But I mean, there's obviously they figured it out. It's a very old system as well. But I mean, we don't have space for that. As you all know, the tunnels don't have a second space for a second tractor of a second train running in the same tunnel next to you. The two separate tunnels. So, it is different. It's a very different system here. So, I mean, but you also have the same argument from young folks in the state as about happy hour. We have Uber. Then I'm like, yeah, we had taxis when I was a kid. I mean, so young folks do have, if they're looking for short distance transportation, you do have, this very robust ride sharing system in the state too. So, if you're concerned about, public transit, there's other ways to get around the city. And it's something that honestly I find fascinating that, young folks will willingly use public use Uber systems almost at will. I'm a walking guy. I learned how until I can't walk as much anymore when I get old enough. But I mean, this is a walking city. I've got used to walking. I'll take the walk 20 minutes or less. No, there's really no other way to do it in Boston. It's faster to walk it. But people will still take a ride share short distance as opposed to walking it. So there's also a cultural difference too.
Yes, that's true too.
So, but that's just my observation. I mean, I'm sure other folks have different opinions on this, and I'm sure folks half our age will have a much different opinion as well. But the stuff I hear in public testimony at state house, and I do pay attention to some things, as you all know. But people will pay higher taxes to have a different quality of life, and this is also true. Young folks will go to a higher tax, and it's not like New York or San Francisco is cheap, but they'll go. And because they want a quality of life that suits them.
Seeing we're talking about transportation, any update on state-funded ferry service for Quincy at all?
You have to check into Bruce on that one.
Yeah.
I haven't honestly pay too much attention. Spring service should be coming online soon. We generally get an email. John and Bruce has been working hard and hard to that. We just generally did it was a partnership with the Winthrop Ferry Service. It's something that can be a conversation constantly around here. As you all know, I'm afraid of the water. But you know, if I can get to Logan Airport in 10 minutes, I will brave the water.
That ever happens, we're going to get a picture of you on a boat.
Yeah, we'll do a live QATV shot of
Oh, that
me
would be good. Yeah.
hanging for dear life on the rail.
With all his life jackets on.
Yeah, that's my apparent and clear fear will be obvious to everyone. It's one of those things that it's always, I mean, it's either gonna have to be private, a complete private sector thing, where they have a business program, or private not-for-profit thing with business. A model that makes sense, or you know, we need a better part of government, whether it be you know Massport or MBTA or not, whatever. You know,
Yeah.
that's really focused in on understanding how water transportation works. Again, it's shocking for a coastal community, coastal city, not have some form of regular water transportation within the harbor. And I get the MBTA's financial problems. Don't get me wrong, that is a legit issue. But it shouldn't have gone to the MBTA to begin with, to be honest with you, when the ferry pilot programs began. It should have been a separate entity.
A private service, right? I mean, it's very successful down the Cape and the island, certainly.
Yeah, the Steamship Authority has a government subsidy to run the ships to the islands. It's a private public partnership. Yeah, right, it's very successful. It's on a very seasonal schedule and it has a point A to point B. Now, obviously, what we like to have up here in the Boston Harbor area is a multiple point shuttle service where you can go from Quincy to Rose Wharf to Logan Airport, to Salem, to Winthrop, to Lynn, and then conversely, be able to go to a place like Hingham and Plymouth and Provincetown as well. We have a Provincetown ferry from Longsworth to Provincetown now. So I mean, we would like to, as opposed to just one destination to another, like they do at the Steamship Authority. Obviously, I think the more that customers would want is a multi-stop, ferry service, that takes a multiple destination. And I've mentioned again and again the airport. When we had the airport shuttle back in the '90s, it was very successful.
Oh yeah, that was a great service. It was unfortunate that it couldn't continue, but it's obviously it demonstrated that there was a market for it.
Yeah, the big dig made it very difficult for everyone. As you all know, again, it's also the only public works project that never closed the road system in the history of anywhere. Most projects that size, the road system is closed, have to divert onto city streets or they have a diversion road instead. So, it's quite remarkable how the big dig was able to pull that off, but also made it very difficult to get to the airport as they kind of built the Ted Williams Tunnel, which us who live south of Boston really does benefit a lot of. We really are beneficiary of this Ted Williams Tunnel as folks living south of Boston. But the water shuttle made a lot of sense. And it'd be great to see the water shuttle come back because I still think it's making a lot of sense.
Yep, I agree. We haven't talked about international affairs in a long time, and I've been reading with interest and shock what's going on in Haiti these days. It's just astounding. And actually, I think just today the president's finally agreed to step down.
Yeah, a little recap for some folks. A Haitian president with all intents and purposes was assassinated by local gangs. And Haiti's always had a very troubled government, despite the fact it's actually a very high natural resource part of the island, actually. If you look at it carefully, it's actually quite rich in resources. But they have a dysfunctional government, and the U.S. has always had multiple interventions into Haiti. As a security interest, and the Dominican Republic, I believe, is like part of the island too. So you got this whole thing, you not let the whole thing devolve. And there's a natural resource component of the Dominican Republic as well. It's also a poorer part, but not as disastrous as Haiti. As the migrant crisis continues, the migrant crisis, a portion of that group is Haitians. And then what they're basically running from is a gang-run island. And that's what it is. And the situation can devolve because they don't have a military government. It's not like the military is going to step in and quash these gangs and then just set up a military dictatorship. Not like I think that's a good thing in life, but when you have this level of civil unrest, somebody's got to step up and do something. And that's not happening in Haiti. And in the past, there's been US intervention where we just sent troops down and just squash these gangs and try to set up the government again. I don't think that's going to happen under this Biden administration. And I don't think it's going to happen again in whoever's the president next. So, basically, mobs. I wouldn't even call them mobs. I don't think they're that organized, but you got multiple factions of gangs going around trying to control the country, and the rape, pillage, burn, kill, recruit along the way. And obviously, their target audience, they recruit young boys in particular to join their gang, and parents don't want to have that happen. So guess what? We have a migrant crisis, and it's always been
Yeah,
interesting.
literally fleeing for their lives. Yeah.
Yeah, they're here. I mean, and one of the reasons that the U.S. government has an interest in Haiti of just going in and just squishing the gangsters and then putting up governments again is to not have what you see today, where people are fleeing Haiti to come here. I mean, that's part of the reason why we have so much intervention on some of these areas, particularly Haiti, to not have what you see now. And no one want the thing is no one wants us to do that, because obviously I have no interest as well, in having US troops on Haitian soil, to basically destroy cartels and gangsters and put up yet another government. So it is like a complete devolution over there. It is very tragic. It's a human tragedy. It is completely there. And these Haitians that are in the United States have no way to go back, because you go back, you know what's waiting for you.
Yeah, I'm reading a story about a hospital that was just completely unstaffed. There were no medical personnel whatsoever. People just praying for some kind of help.
And well, a lot of charitable organizations, provide medical assistance, to build hospitals, and they build schools, and they'll do workforce, and they try to bring some portable technology to try to increase quality of life. That's all wasted now. An unstable government, has created a circumstance where, there's no control through the whole island. And what's going to happen is fiefdoms going to get set up eventually, and a lot of good work by people's going to be lost in a blink of an eye. I mean, the earthquake itself was devastating, and the infrastructure has already been wrecked from past insurrections, mob rule, and earthquakes. And of course, it's in a hurricane zone too. So the only solution, is somebody else going in there, or you arm somebody else to go in there and deal with the issue. But I don't see an end in sight unless these various gangs cut a deal and then set up a new government. I have no idea what to do in this scenario, because, like I said, historically speaking, the US government just goes in there and just takes care of business and reestablishes order and sets up a government and walks away again.
Right.
So I don't see the migrant situation of Haitians ending anytime soon, as the island continues to devolve dramatically. And if you think it's okay to expose your children to that situation, you're welcome to go to Haiti. It's not like we're not stopping people from visiting. But I mean, I can't see any sensible parent anywhere on the planet saying, "Oh yeah, we should stay in this gang-ridden area with this rape, pillage, murder. And oh, by the way, they're going to recruit my child into this gang, and he could be dead in 2 years." I mean,
Yeah.
it's a real thing, folks. People have this like thinking that's like they're just coming, they're coming, they're coming, because they're running.
Yeah, it's life or death, quite literally, for sure. So, any prayers, I'm sure, from all faiths would be welcome.
No, absolutely. Absolutely. A lot of folks from the Asian world isn't here because. I mean, they're all fleeing something, and obviously there's dictatorships and governments evolving. It's not like people come to the United States, because. I mean, they're leaving because the life at home is good. Very few Americans leave the United States permanently, unless they're going to some place where they're looking for a different quality of life, which everyone has a right to. We don't stop people from leaving this country. This is one of those few countries where if you want to leave, you want to give your citizenship, You're more than happy to do that. It's not like we force you to stay. Like some countries, like China, we basically, they're trying to force you to stay, not let you leave. You'd have the freedom. If people think that, these folks coming here have a better life than you do here, you're more than welcome to go there.
Also, we haven't talked in a long time about it's kind of a converse situation. Taiwan, things seem to be just going along rosily there.
Yeah, it's an interesting political situation in Taiwan. A third political party made headwinds in the last presidential election that prevented a guaranteed majority. It was a popularity win for the incumbent government, but the incumbent government also lost majority control of the legislative branch. A coalition parliament needs to happen because of this third party to have a prime minister run their legislative branch. That part didn't get reported very much in the news. And as a result, you got a deadlock, a legislative branch, and a presidency. And there's also a bit of an interesting dynamic over there. Taiwanese Chinese perceive themselves as Taiwanese nationals, not Chinese nationals. And this has been a progression going on for multiple generations. It is a major economy. Everyone heard about Taiwan Semiconductor, which, interestingly enough, has the factories in China. But is the chip center of the world. They're a biotech center, they're an education center, they're a major port, they're a hub for travel throughout the Asian countries because of location. The Strait of Taiwan handles like half the trade that goes to everywhere in that part of the world, in and out, especially going to Japan and Korea. It's actually faster to go to the Strait of Taiwan than it is to go on the other side of Taiwan. It is a strategic location, not just militarily, but also economically. And the government there, has a fine balancing act where they're not looking to aggravate China, but they want to remain a close U.S. ally. They recognize the country because China's been buying off other countries to no longer recognize Taiwan as a country. It's a vast diminution of what few remaining left is basically a handful. And the government's run this very careful thing where it's like, okay, well, we're not independent, but we run ourselves, but we're not a country. We don't want you to be part of you. But the population has definitely moved in a direction where they are, I wouldn't say pro-independence, but definitely have a different cultural and national identity. There's some of the same problem we have. The really high inflation, the health system has got strained badly from COVID. They're still trying to recover from that. They want to prevent talent from fleeing the island because of fear of invasion. And there's actually this little piece of Taiwan that's actually on mainland China that belongs to Taiwan that China's never invaded, which is kind of interesting. And of course, there's a tourist problem and trade problem because the biggest tourist trade partner is China. And China's been trying to strangle them on the economics of that front on preventing foreign tourist money from coming in, which is a big part of anybody's economy now. So, it's a fine balancing of a bit of a deadlock government. And this balancing act of the majority party to be able to, keep the population sentiment, in line with their sentiment, but not screw up the foreign affairs. They have a challenging economy like we do right now because of the hyperinflation and, the crazy trade embargoes from the Chinese, or the Chinese
Yeah,
government.
I'm sure they're watching the U.S. presidential election closely as well.
Actually, every country in Asia is watching the presidential election. It's not just the Europeans.
Right.
As everyone knows, we still have troops stationed in Korea, a troop stationed in Okinawa. We have troops stationed in Singapore. We have a joint cooperative use of, I think, half a dozen military bases in the Philippines. We are a longtime partner of the Australians. People forget Australia is actually part of the Pacific. It's its own continent and not a country, but it's actually part of that Pacific security. There's a very strong interest from all these countries that are longtime post-World War II allies to have a security in terms of just not just militarily, but also economic security because control of the water controls trade. In
Right.
the US, whether you all like it or not, is the biggest security guarantee of maritime trade.
And it's being challenged now, certainly, in the Red Sea with the Houthi rebels too.
Yeah, that's going to be going on for a while. They're getting money from Iran to market the equipment for Iran. There's no way to keep replacing all this, ability to hit ships with fairly modern weaponry. They did set one on fire, to set a fertilizer ship on fire, which I'm trying to remember which country flag it was flying under. But I mean, it's not like we can't hit them, and the British can hit them, and we can do it, and the Chinese can as well, and then the French and any other country could hit them. But again, it's up to the US and the Europeans, to provide security inside an area. And the Europeans obviously have a very strong interest, because the Suez is how you get trading out of the Mediterranean. And it's a major trade port, and it saves, as we talked about before, it saves you money, but also saves the environment, because you want to cut the travel time as much as possible, because the less fuel you burn, the less impact you have on the environment. And cargo by water is still the most cost-effective, fuel-effective, environmentally best way to move an immense amount of cargo around the world than flying it. Flying is worse for the environment, and you can't carry as much, as we learned in COVID, where all we did was fly stuff at one point because of the crucial nature of medical supplies that we need to move globally on a moment's notice, not just in the US, but a global level, which was not good for the environment. But I mean, I don't know, pandemic. People weren't too worried about the environment when everyone's dying around you. So, trains and cargo ships in the water is, still the best way to go around it right now. A lot of people from Mass Maritime, people who get Mass Maritime, have people on cargo ships.
Interesting. Yeah, that's right. I forgot about that. Let's bring it back home and talk a little bit about the budget process on Beacon Hill. I guess it's kind of in between now, right?
Yeah, I mean, budget meetings have started with the House Chair Ways and Means, Senate House Means Joint Committee hearings have been ongoing. I think there's a schedule out in public today to let you know which constitutional officers, as well as their secretariats and their subdivided agencies, need to go before Ways and Means for questioning, as well as justification of the requests and the governor's recommendation. Obviously, there'll be a public comment period. You can do public comment now by sending, emails to phone calls, emails, and postcards, or letters to House and Ways and Means. You can do that today. Obviously, I'm picking up more meetings all the time on people asking me to support various budget initiatives. And I'll have my own meeting of Ways and Means the 20th, actually, 20th March.
Oh,
And
okay.
House Inclusion Caucus will have theirs on the 27th. So, as I told you last time, I'm juggling multiple hats all the time. This is the degree of herding cats. So, obviously, part of my community chairmanship, I do talk to the various state agencies. I have to interact with regularly to find out what their budgets are, why they want it, and provide my input to Ways and Means about my thoughts about how these various agencies I deal with are operating. It's also a good time to get, if there's a bill or other subject matter interest, I can try to slip that in during the conversation. This conversation is very short, about 15 plus minutes. It's not like I have an hour. So, efficiency in conversation is crucial. The ability to convey a lot of information in a brief moment is kind of part of the job here. We always provide backup, but you can articulate quickly what you're looking for and why. Generally, that's extremely effective.
Speaking of public hearings, folks should know that there's a National Grid's having a public hearing at North Quincy High School March 19th at 7 p.m. I guess they're looking for rate increases.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of part of the job here. Is I actually used to I actually did one of these in City Hall so many years ago, then during a National Grid increase, three assistant attorney generals, of which I was one of them back in I think 2008.
Just a child then.
Just a child then, was at Quincy City Hall all night, listening to testimony regarding the rate increase. The Attorney General's office does not comment on it because we are a litigant, so to speak, in the matter, but we get the public input, as well as the DPU back then. It's their rate plan has come up, generally the 5-year rate plans, although the utility can ask to come in earlier if they feel a need, but generally it's a 5-year rate plan. And we still run a decoupled rate system, meaning that how much electricity they sell to you isn't necessarily relative to the bottom line of revenues. And it's not as simple as saying they have a guaranteed dollar amount of money, saying, they have, like, here's your guaranteed budget number, just do this. it's not that simple. It's actually quite a complicated formula where we know what the minimum revenue is, but they're encouraged to try to reduce consumption. So, it's a little, it's very involved. It's a crazy problem. So it's people think it's like cable TV. It's not cable TV. It's an actual rate usage, which encourages reduction of consumption, but guarantee that they guarantee the rate of return. So yeah, it's involved, but we're a big state in terms of energy consumption, and this is part of the process. So the people can't get to the public hearing. The DPU website has the ability to make a, have you make a public comment regarding the rate increase. I promise you, nobody is going to advocate for a rate increase. I've never seen it, never going to happen. No one in the public's going to say, "Hey, raise my bill." It's not. But this is, part of the process. And the rate, hearings take about, I think, less than 3 months into the law. It's the law actually requires a very specific time frame once the hearings begin, once the process begins to have it completed. It's very fast. It's actually very, very fast. It's actually did somewhat. It this policy was put in place because people didn't want to have 1 year hearings on rates because it creates a delay, and then you have this like makeup time of the rate adjustment to ensure that the rate case follows through from when the rates and then rates start. So you don't have like this weird like 1 year catch up. But at the same time, as a guy that worked in the AG's office, you're now in a seller rate to prove your case, trying to chip the rate down. And having more time, gives you a little bit more time to go through like the bazillion things of paperwork, plus the analysts, plus the engineers, plus the accountants that we had used to help us on this analysis. And of course, the attorney's got to understand what's going on because the attorney's going to want us to advocate to you. So it was, as you can tell, when I was there, there was a whole lot of complexities. I had to learn like the accounting methodologies, the actual engineering stuff. I had to talk to the various interests, not just the general public, but also various unions, because obviously the unionized shops. And there's environmental groups, and then you have all these other programs like energy efficiency. We're talking about charging stations now, and you got all these different factors rolling in, renewable energy, renewable credits. It's just, safety to public, safety for workers, infrastructure and system stability. I mean, it's actually a lot going on. And expenses is a big part of the AG's investigation. Is like, what are you doing for expenses, and why are you paying these this stuff and reimbursements to executives? So on the flip side, a little less time for the AG's office to very thoroughly just comb through everything. So on a good front, yeah, you don't want to like create a back rate backup against customers once the rate's set. You should have this done timely. The flip side, do you have enough time really to just hammer the utility on every single detail to create accountability?
Well, we've done it again, Jackie. We've talked for an hour.
Yeah, just about 55-ish minutes at this point or so. And it's amazing how time flies. I did watch the last one, by the way, because every so often I do watch myself. I was slouching a bit, and I'm doing the "and" which I hear far too often, and the "ums" come up too often, so I'm trying to come up with the answer, and I do have a little bit of a stutter and a little bit stagnated on words where there's this funny pause between the first word and second word. You've seen it happen like 3 times, I've noticed already in this conversation. So it's actually kind of funny listening to yourself. But we also are talking on the fly.
That's right. Yeah, we're not. There's no script here, folks. This
Yeah,
is
so.
totally ad lib, improv.
Yeah, so not surprising, I do have these like, little pauses, these little stutters, and these like, then, so what if?
Well, yeah, because you never know what I'm going to ask you.
Yeah, as I'm trying to like process in the fly here and using these little sounds in my voice to try to buy time as my brain is trying to catch up, pulling, as you're making me pull random data sets and rapid analysis in my brain on random topics that we want to talk about, which is a lot of fun. It's a great exercise for me. And it gives you guys a sense that I'm human as anybody else, and I do know some stuff, I don't know some stuff. And some stuff is more in depth, and some is a little less in depth about conversations based on what I do not know. And the stuff, of course, changes. I mean, we could talk about the Asian situation in 1 month's time, maybe things have changed completely, for example. And we could talk
That's
about
right.
changing in economy, changing in politics. Also, Timothy, since we didn't talk about this yet, Senator Walter Timothy is leaving the state senate. He's going to run for Norfolk County Clerk of Courts. I'm sure many of you don't realize that the courts in Norfolk County has an elected manager, which is the person who runs the courthouses, which is the civil courthouses, and that's the Clerk of Courts of Norfolk County. So his father, Walter Sr., has been there for a long time and is retiring. It's a 6-year term, I believe. And Walter Timothy is running at a Democratic primary for that seat. He's going to be leaving that Senate seat. So Walter's been in the legislature a very long time. And I'm going to wish him the best in supporting him on moving on to the get a job at the courthouse. So changes continue at the state house, Joe.
Absolutely, yeah, and that'll open up a whole bevy of candidates for his space in the Senate, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's an interesting district because he started in Middleton and he ended in Bridgewater.
Big district, yeah.
Big district, kind of a little bit of slivery looking line going south. And very diverse district. You got Milton and Randolph, Canton, I believe Avon, you got Sharon, Stoughton, or parts of, and you got Bridgewater. These are not communities that have a lot in common. Once you really look, yeah, it's it, this set of districts is actually a lot of non-commonalities of geography and demographics. So whoever comes out to run for that has to appeal to a very broad audience. If it's a big primary, obviously a geographic areas matter. Maybe people vote by geography, and depending if you come up from the bigger voting block geography, if it's a big primary number of folks, then you will get the one of the biggest biggest voter block will win. But right now, there's no clear indications about who's going to run for that seat. It was just announced Monday, yesterday, that Walter is leaving. As I said, I'm supporting Walter, and as a longtime colleague. We'll see what happens next time out in terms of this situation. Papers are due April 30th in the clerk's office, so we need 300 signatures to run for Senate. So this is very doable in like a 1 month period. If you want to make a decision April 1st, run for Senate. Plenty of time to get your signatures.
Yep, and I think the state primary is September 3rd, if I'm correct.
Yeah, we talked about this last time. Very close, as close as you're going to get to Labor Day as you can. I mean, I think Labor Day is Monday the first.
Yeah.
Oh, is it no second? Second.
Yes, the second. Yeah.
Yep,
Because the current
second.
primary will be on a Tuesday, right? Yeah.
Yeah, right after Labor Day, and it's actually an early November election too. It's I think November 5th. So, but yeah, it's a sprint now. Primaries are split a sprint. If you didn't get an opponent announced back in January, the incumbent obviously gets an advantage if you announce in April. Right? If you announce in a primary against me in April or May, I've already had a 4 month advantage on it. Right?
Right.
But in an open seat, there's no advantage.
Right.
Everybody's making a sprint from April essentially to September, and it's early September. And we all know August is really quiet. Take it from a guy campaigns. August is a hard time to find voters, people. It ain't easy. I'm telling you right.
Everybody's on the beach, yeah.
Yeah, it's a hard one to campaign.
Right.
August 1st hits because you can't find people. But yeah, you got to raise the money. And obviously, incumbent candidates or reps or counselors or selectmen that have good sized bank accounts going in will have some strategic advantages. Can't undervalue money and inflationary costs. Mailing's expensive now, folks. Getting good printing done's expensive. If you have to do cable TV advertising, if you're a big geography like you're in Western Mass, you actually advertise in Local 22 out there as well as cable. It's expensive. So you got to be able to raise some money and a lot of it quick. So if you're a sitting incumbent that actually has a good sized bank account, that gives you a very strategic advantage for running for office.
Stay tuned. All right.
More changes are coming, I'm telling you right now. We're not done.
How do we get a hold of you, Techie?
617-722-2370. 617-722-2370 is the phone number. As you've heard, I'm in the office 2 days this week. I'm doing virtual meetings. First half of the week, people are seeing my dining room, not just you all who are watching on YouTube on QA TV. Room 42, as I said, stop on by. You can email me at tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, TACKEY.CHAN@mahouse.gov. Obviously, we prefer phone calls and emails, strongly recommended. We do have social media just so you can see where I am, State Representative Tacky Chan, as well as at Tacky Chan on X. And we have malegislature.gov. Feel free to look at our old public hearings and watch me say weird things in other forums, as well as tackychan.org for the purposes of just getting some reference phone numbers. And obviously, here we are at QATV every 5 to 7 days with some holidays off. Actually, Joe gets the holiday. Try to give you some news. And if you like our show or Joe's show, it's not really mine, you can email Joe he'll sift through questions that you may ask and make it part of the program. So, Joe, you're eagerly my part of my staff now.
Okay, I'll be sending you a bill. No, kidding, just kidding. But
So,
yeah, I'd be happy to hear from folks. Absolutely.
yeah, and AM in Quincy with Joe in the morning, something get your 10-minute quick hit in what's going on locally. So many ways to reach us. I do pay attention to my emails. The staff and I both look at it. We sort it. We figure it out. We prioritize, and we do our best to try to figure what you're telling us and get back to you once we actually know what's going on. Obviously, we have a good time talking to you. And what was also this time of year? Oh yeah, it's this week is the first official announcement of the pandemic.
Yes, 4 years ago this week. Yep, that's right.
Over 7 million people have passed away. Over 1 million people have passed away in the United States from this disease. So it is actually a somber week for a different reason as well.
This is true. Yeah. But we do have St. Patrick's Day coming up. So happy St. Patrick's Day.
Happy St. Patrick's Day, Joe, and both of us at least Irish for one day.
That's right. You'll be Tacky O'Chan, and I'll be Joe
Yeah.
O'Catalano. Thanks, Jack.
Take care, Joe.